I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. We have a lot of ways to describe our class divide in America, us and them, the haves and have-nots. In 2004, John Edwards gave us his Two Americas rhetoric to illustrate the disappearing middle class, and most recently, the Occupy Wall Street movement has fine-tuned things by describing our situation as the 1% versus the 99%. But could the class divide be where the division ends? A new study finds that Americans, whether they're rich, poor, left-leaning, or right of center, we all pretty much want to live in a country where there is economic equality. Here with me to talk about this are the brains behind the research. On the line from North Carolina is behavioral economist Dan Ariely. He's a professor at Duke University. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Also with us is Michael Norden, a professor at Harvard Business School. His forthcoming book is Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
So we're in a campaign season where there has been a lot of verbiage thrown around about wealth distribution, income inequality. Certainly this plays to a lot of people because they heard it from the Occupy movement defined as 99% versus 1%. So let's just put on the table the fact that there is some data that speaks to what the wealth income distribution gap really is. Dan Ariely, what is it? How big is it?
So imagine we took all Americans and we put them in the one big line from the poorest to the wealthiest, and then we divided them into five buckets. The 20% who have the most wealth, the next 20%, the next, and the poorest. And then I asked you, how much wealth do you think the bottom two buckets, the bottom 40% have? And most people think it's about 8% or about 10%. But in fact, it's 0.3%. The bottom 40% basically owns nothing. And then the top 20% owns about 84% of the wealth. And this distribution of wealth, of how much each bucket has, is what economists basically call the Gini coefficient. What is the slope of this line basically describe about how unequal the distribution is. And the U.S. is quite high. We are the worst from the developed world, and we are in the same category as countries like China and some unpleasant countries in Africa in terms of a wealth distribution. Now, so this is kind of the reality. And the first thing that Mike and I found is that people don't appreciate that reality. People don't understand how uneven the wealth distribution is. But the next question we wanted to really talk about was, what do people want? So economists tend to think about those things in terms of what's efficient? What kind of inequality do you want that motivate people to work hard and not want to be about the poor? And what's kind of the right level? We took a different tack and we said, what society do people want to live in? What kind of wealth distribution gives you a sense that this is a good, useful society? And what kind of wealth distribution are ones that people just don't want to live in? And to do that, we followed a very famous philosopher called John Rawls. And John Rawls had a beautiful definition for what's a just society. He said that a just society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you would be willing to enter it in a random place. And if you think about it, it's really a beautiful definition. Because if you're very wealthy, you might want the wealthy to have lots of money and the poor to have very little. If you're very poor, you might want to have a more socialistic society. But if you don't know where you'll enter, you have to consider all perspectives. And John Rawls called this the veil of ignorance. So we basically defined this. We didn't use the word veil of ignorance, but we described this idea of a society you know everything about and you would fall into a random place to a very, very large sample of Americans. And what did we find? We find that when Americans create a society, they build a very equal society. Not socialistic. It's not a society that everybody has the same amount of money. In fact, wealth. Nobody created that. But people created a more even distribution than anything that exists in the world. So in some sense, Americans really want a much more equal society when they get to think about it in abstract terms and the veil of ignorance.
So, Michael Norden, one of the underlying questions here, or one of the underlying pieces of information that came out from your work, is that Americans are not clear about, as Dan Ariely has said, exactly how big the gap is. They can envision, if left in an abstract way, how they would like to see the distribution happen. And I think that's based on what they think the gap is currently. But really, what your work showed is that they have no idea how wide the gap is.
That's right. So part of what we wanted to show is that if we just ask people straight up, as Dan was saying, what do you think the current distribution of wealth is, that because it's very hard to see what the distribution of wealth is, because most of us every day don't see incredibly wealthy people, and we also often don't see incredibly poor people, that a lot of Americans would really underestimate the extent to which wealth is distributed unequally already. And in fact, that's what we found. So if you look at the latest numbers, it looks like, for example, the top 20% has 85% of the wealth. People think they have about 60%. So they know that wealthy people are wealthy, but they're really underestimating just how wealthy the wealthy people are. And as Dan was saying, when we ask people, what would you like it to be? They want it to be even more equal than they think it is, which is already much more equal than it actually is. So there's a really large chasm between what the reality is right now, what people think it is, and then really what they'd want it to be in the abstract.
And let's make the point that it didn't matter where you were on the ideological spectrum, on the political spectrum, whether you were Democrat or Republican, you didn't quite get what the gap was, and you also wanted it more evenly distributed.
That's right. So the very richest people in our sample and the most conservative people and, of course, the poorest and the most liberal people, every single group that we've surveyed, when we ask them what they'd like America to look like, all of them want it to be more equal than they think it is. Every single group. So even the wealthiest conservatives still want an America that's more equal than the current state of affairs.
And so let me give you example of this? So in one question, we showed people a distribution of wealth of a country that was more equally distributed than Sweden and a distribution of wealth as it is in the U.S. And we asked them, which one would you choose? And 92% of Americans said that they would choose the Swedish, the more equal than Sweden distribution. When we break it by Republicans and Democrats, for example, for Democrats it's 93%. For Republicans it's 90.5%. So different, but really very, the difference was very small. People agreed to a very, very high degree. Now, here is the kind of puzzling and interesting, but also promising thing. When you look at politics in the States, it's incredibly hard to imagine that people on both aisles agree on anything. But when we do our study, under the veil of ignorance, people look like they agree basically to a very high degree. And I think there are two causes for this, what seems to be a big gap, but in fact, a lot of similarity. The first one is the roles definition. The moment you have to ask yourself an abstract question of what society is just, people actually are quite similar. And I think of this like wine tasting. You know, if you taste some wine and you have the label and the price, you're going to be influenced by that. But if you don't have those things, we actually become much similar. Similarly, when you think about just society, if you have your own wealth and your own position in society and so on, this is influencing what you think is just and not just. But when you abstract all of this away and you have to consider where you might fall in a random place, now people become similar. And the second thing is that I think the role of politicians in many ways is to obscure our similarity and make it more, make differences seem more apparent or larger than they really are. I think politicians come up with all kinds of phrases like, you know, death panels and big government and so on that are meant to get people not to think carefully about what they think is right and wrong, and instead just to kind of latch on these phrases and vote without actually thinking too much.
So the thing is that what's interesting about this is, so you've just said people don't understand what the gap is. First of all, the gap is real, and that's quantified by data. So that's the first thing, yeah. And it's huge. The second thing is that most Americans are wildly off in their understanding of how wide the gap is. And the third thing is that when they think about wealth and income distribution, they want it more evenly divided, whether they be Democrat or Republican, left-leaning or right-leaning, should be right-leaning, they should be more evenly divided. Now, having said all of that, What was fascinating to me then, in the wake of the Occupy movement, when the occupiers were saying, it's not fair that this quantifiable gap exists and it ought to be redistributed, people, some, went nuts. Said, what are you talking about? That's socialism. We're not doing that.
Yeah.
So how do you explain that, Michael Norton?
You know, I think we were able to show this enormous consensus among people of all political stripes and all walks of life in what they want in the ideal. And it does seem to suggest that what people are really clamoring for is redistribution of wealth, that if people don't want poor people to be so poor and they don't want wealthy people to be so wealthy, surely we should do something to redistribute the wealth. The problem is, though, that as soon as you start to talk about how to redistribute the wealth, suddenly people have very, very different beliefs about what should be done. So, for example, if you think that there are too many poor people and poor people should have better outcomes, some people think the way to do that is to tax the wealthy more and redistribute that income down. We might call them liberals or Democrats. Other people think that what you should do in order to improve the outcomes of the poor is to tax the wealthy less so the wealthy can create jobs for the poor people so that they can move up into the middle class. And leaving aside which of those perspectives is correct or incorrect, you can really start to see very big differences, even though the ultimate goal of an ideal society is the same, really, really interesting differences of opinion and how exactly we should behave to get there.
Yeah, and I also think that what happened is that people focus too much on the how and not enough on what goal we're trying to achieve. It's also important to figure out that there's another important way to create wealth equality, which is education. So taxing people to a high degree solves the immediate problem. We have immediate issue with redistribution. But of course, the long-term way to redistribute wealth more equally is to give more people more opportunities that come from lots of things, including education. And nobody seems to be objecting to that approach. And I think it's one of the approaches we have to try.
We're talking about class in the U.S., who has money, who doesn't, and what it would take to even things out, as we're looking at data that demonstrates that a lot of people want to do that. I'm speaking with behavioral economist Dan Ariely and Michael Norton of the Harvard Business School. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH.
We often think that, you know, a warm winter is good for ticks.
We hear a lot about the dangers of ticks and Lyme disease. Now there's new research out on these tiny predators.
A dry summer might be bad for ticks. That's not showing up in our data. Tick numbers are driven largely by how many white-footed mice and secondarily chipmunks there are in the woods.
I'm Sean Corcoran. Join me for our series, Tiny Predators, Innovations to Fight New England Ticks, tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Maine Maritime Museum, celebrating its 50th anniversary and inviting you to experience Maritime Maine at Camden Windjammer Days, August 31st and September 1st and 2nd. More information at experiencemaritimemaine.info. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at groganco.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. We're talking about wealth distribution in the United States, a big issue for people who are living through financial struggles on a daily basis and a big issue on the campaign trail. Here with me to talk about how we think about the distribution of wealth are Dan Ariely and Michael Norton. Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist, a professor at Duke University. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Michael Norton is a professor at Harvard Business School. His forthcoming book is titled Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. So, Michael Norton, let me ask this question of you. We've just discussed that there are different ways that people feel very strongly about how wealth should be redistributed, even though when asked to propose a plan for wealth distribution, everybody, no matter where they are on the ideological spectrum, would like to see it more even. I wonder if Americans are fond of what I call the kindness of strangers from Blanche DuBois and Streetcar Named Desire. because there's this program called Secret Millionaire, where the millionaire observes somebody who's struggling, needs money, and offers money from his or her own pocket that she or he deems worthy to accept it. Now, that's a situation where the person with the money, with the resources, is able to determine who should get it and how much they should get it and blah, blah, blah. People really respond to this. This is, you know, it feels good. And yet, if you broaden that out to some kind of policy, I don't know what it looks like, Michael Norton.
Yeah, you know, it's a fantastic point. I think that we do see differences of opinion. So if you ask Americans after you tell them basically that wealth is more unequally distributed than they thought, should something be done? Most people will say yes. If you change that question just slightly and insert one different word, which is, should the government do something about it, suddenly you see people really disagreeing. And part of what's underlying that, of course, liberals think that the government is the mechanism by which inequality should be reduced. Conservatives tend to think more along the lines of what you were just suggesting, which is that, yes, poor people should be helped, but if anything, it should be done through private charitable contributions. And in fact, if you look at the data, politically conservative people often give more to charity than politically liberal people, partly through their church and religious organization. So there is absolutely something about, should it be private citizens making this decision, or should it be the government taking the tax money and then making these decisions for us? If you think about an organization like Kiva, where the way that you help people in other countries is you give them a loan for a very small business, and then they have to pay that loan back to you. That is, at a very small level, exactly the idea of, I know who's getting the money, I can decide if they're worthy of it, and they're accountable to me to use it in some way to better themselves. And if they don't, there are real consequences. Again, liberals and conservatives have very different views on accountability, the government's role, all of these different factors in reshaping the level of inequality.
So, Dan Ariely, one thing we know that Occupy did do, for wherever you are on the spectrum and how you feel like the mechanism ought to work or not, government or private, is that it put income inequality, you know, as something that normal people walking around think about, which is not clear to me that that people were thinking about it before in real ways. And we've talked about how this may play out on the campaign trail. And I looked at an article from the Associated Press during the time that Republican nominee Mitt Romney was on vacation. He's on vacation at Lake Winnipesaukee. He's on a yacht. He's enjoying himself, and well, he should. This is no critique of his being on vacation or enjoying his money as he wishes. On the other hand, at the same time, somebody asked President Obama, well, you know, what about vacations for you? And let's put aside the fact that we know that he went to Martha's Vineyard and it's a pricey place. He talked about being a kid and having an opportunity to take a vacation every once in a while, and at Howard Johnson's, and how exciting it was to go swimming in the pool and spend the whole day there and go to the vending machine. And the question came up in this piece was, what does it mean to have one candidate, at least, who doesn't have any of that experience at all in his life, and another one who very much has it, even though it may be in the past? And what does it do for about how we think about income inequality?
So let me kind of put a couple of speculations out there. Of course, we don't really know, but I'll speculate. I think one question is, how do we view the poor? Some people view the poor as people who are basically are inept or don't deserve it or just are not good enough. There's lots of research recently, mostly by Eldar Shafir and his team at Princeton, that says that the poor are actually not very different from the wealthy in many aspects, aside from the fact that they have many more constraints on their lives and many more challenges. And the analogy he gives is a beautiful analogy of a suitcase. And he says, if you're wealthy, it's as if you have a large suitcase. And it's as if when you want to pack, you could just put anything in there and you have enough space. And if you need another sweater, there's no problem. If you're very poor, it's as if your suitcase is not big enough for everything you need. So first of all, you have to make decisions. And then you have to pack very carefully and everything has to fit inside. And if you change your mind, lots of things have to move. You have to put something in and something out. And this approach to think about the poor basically suggests that they are not very different from us, from the people who are not that poor. But their life situations are very different. And their life situations are such that they're not allowing them very easily to escape out of that. And I think there's a very big difference in how do you view the lower stratas of society. Are you view them as different people, or you view it as basically luck, saying, I could have just as well been in the other part of society. And this puts into a bigger discussion about what's the role of luck and what's the role of skill in society and where we are. And I think to the extent that people recognize that lots of luck plays a big role in where we end up being, it becomes incredibly important to realize that, yes, I too could have been in a very different strata in society. What I have right now, it's not just a function of who I am, it's also a function of luck, and I could have had a very different life. And wouldn't I want a very different social support system if I had a very different life? So that's one thing. The second thing I actually want to point out, that there's really interesting research. We said something about education earlier, about the role of education in the financial crisis. And here is the basic finding. The basic finding is that people want their kids to go to good schools. And by wanting them to go to good schools, because of the way we fund schools, people move to very expensive neighborhoods. In fact, they move to neighborhoods that they can't afford. And what happens as a consequence? They overstretch their budgets. They sometimes have to declare bankruptcy. It also increases domestic violence and divorce within the family. And the idea is that because education is based on the amount of money that you have, if you have lots of money, you can move to a good neighborhood that has good skills. And if you don't have a lot of money, you have to move to be in a not so good neighborhood with not so good schools, and your kids have a lower chance of moving forward. This separation between the wealthy and the poor based on schooling is actually increasing the difference in society. And again, it suggests that it's not so much about us. If you would take somebody incredibly successful in life right now, and you would have just made them born to very poor parents and go to very mediocre or even bad schools, you can ask yourself, what would prevail, their inherent talent or the circumstances that they will be presented with? And I think that the more we recognize that the circumstances are important, the more we should want to give more people more opportunities in society.
And yet, Michael Norden, what we're saying are some of those pathways are being extremely limited. And if people try to find a way to a pathway, if it's a little bit not following the rules, I refer you to the story of the woman, the poor woman in Connecticut, who registered her child at a school that she shouldn't have because she didn't live there. But she was determined to try to give her kid that education that Dan Ariely is talking about. And they came down hard on her. They're, you know, about putting her in jail and slapping her with fines, and none of that could she afford. And it came down to she just wanted the kid to have a chance to go to that school.
You know, I think there's a real issue of fairness of education, where in general Americans believe that all children should have an opportunity to get a very good education. But there are disparities, and when certain people seem as though they're taking advantage of a system or trying to game the system, even though they're doing that because perhaps the system is rigged a little bit unfairly, they still feel as though that person is behaving unfairly, and therefore they can come down very harshly on them. I think that the agreement that we see in our surveys about the idea that more money should be put toward education, as Dan was saying, it's one of the few areas where we really see Republicans and Democrats agreeing that it is okay to have the government give more money to early childhood education, because that will help in the longer term with wealth inequality.
Michael Norden, yes, go ahead, Dan.
So there are two other things that I want to emphasize about the survey. One of them is actually, Mike, can you describe the survey we did at Harvard with the different departments?
Sure. So we did our same survey that we described earlier. What do you think wealth inequality looks like, and what do you think it should look like at Harvard? So we got alumni of Harvard University to fill out the survey as well. Many people have said, surely people who are highly educated understand that wealth inequality is as bad as it is. And maybe those people also, their ideals differ from the American public. And what we find is that's not the case at all. So graduates of Harvard, whether they come from the law school, the business school, arts and sciences, which have different liberal and political, liberal and conservative leanings. Again, everyone underestimates the current level of inequality, and everyone that we survey, again, still wants things to be more equal than they are.
Now, the people in the business school wanted to give slightly less money for the poor, but very, very little. We also did this with listeners of NPR and with readers of Forbes magazine, and we didn't find much difference. There's one other thing I want to mention. The Rawls definition of a just society basically said that people are placed randomly in some wealth distribution, and they have to be there. And one of the questions was, what about the belief in mobility? In the U.S., there's at least a big belief that whatever you're born in, you can end up somewhere depending on your skills. And could it be that people are willing to tolerate such high inequality because they think it's because of people's ability to move? Basically, it means that if you're rich, it's because you decided to work hard, and if you're poor, it's because you decided not to work hard. So we tested that. We created one version that had the Rawls definition of a just society, and we told people, whatever position you're put into, you're going to stay there for the rest of your life. Mm. And in the other condition, we say, whatever position you're put into, you can move up and down depending on your skill and your effort. What happens? So there was slight difference. It's true that the more you believe in social mobility, the more you're willing to accept inequality, because you say it's a choice variable. But it was, again, a small difference. It didn't really overwhelm any of the results. It just changed things slightly. So even the belief in social mobility did not really change our results, suggesting that they're incredibly robust to all kinds of other interventions.
That when you were mentioning that example, it reminds me of going to a restaurant where people determine whether or not they tip or not based on if they say, well, the waitress is already getting a salary, so I don't really have to provide more. You know, she's already in a position to get some income, so there you have it. So it's really interesting in that discussion. Michael Norton, I was taken with a TED Talk you did about how when you, in another experiment, handed out money to people and asked them to either spend it on themselves or other people, that the people who spent it on other people were happier. So if we could tie all of this together and say, if people understood the gap, realized it, which is a huge thing, you've proved that most any group you can tap, NPR, Forbes, Harvard, Duke, wherever, people don't believe the gap is that wide, don't understand it to be. But if they did, then is there more of a sense of, we may not agree how to close the gap, but we must be working on it?
In fact, we're doing some research now where we're looking almost at exactly this, which is the idea of, if it's the case that we need to raise taxes to alter inequality right now, how should we think about taxes in a way that makes people feel less like it's an evil scheme by the government to rob us of our money, and more like paying taxes is part of a social good where we all contribute to a pool, and because there's a pool of money, that's then distributed among people so that there's a social safety net and things like this. And in fact, one of the ways that we're looking at this is, if you think about letting people have a little bit of choice in where their taxes go. So what if I told you this year, here's your tax bill, I'm going to let you allocate 5% of that total amount wherever you want in the government. Not all of it, obviously, because that could create a lot of problems, but just a little bit of control over where you send your tax money. Our goal is, and we have some data to support this, that having some say in where that goes. So if you are supportive of the military, you can send it there. If you like Head Start, you can send it there. Wherever you want to send it, that this makes people actually happier with paying their taxes. This is research with a colleague, Kate Lamberton, at the University of Pittsburgh. And also it actually makes them more likely to pay their taxes, which suggests that you can grow the tax pool by letting people have some say in where their taxes go, and then we could actually have tax money go where people really wanted it to.
So my
I should point out, if I didn't grow up in this country, and coming to the U.S., I noticed two kind of seemingly opposing things. On one hand, people here are incredibly generous. People give a lot of money to charity, more than any other place in the world I've seen or heard about. At the same time, people have objections to taxes at the higher level that I've seen anywhere. And in some sense, taxes are like charity. You're giving money to be used in society in other ways. And it always puzzled me, how come Americans are so generous in one hand and so resisting to taxes on another. And I think what Mike is proposing, which is it's this basically personal responsibility and the right to drive where your money is coming, that is differentiating between these two seemingly similar way of contributing to the public pool.
But it also thinks, and this is my last question to you both, is that it comes back down to the central issue of your piece, which is that people do not believe the gap as large as you have demonstrated it to be. So if perception is reality, the first step of doing anything, of having any discussion, of having a reframing, has to start with people believing the data. So I don't know how you get people to believe the data first.
So we're trying, right? We're publishing it. We're making it available. We're trying to get people to think about it. And, you know, even if you don't believe our data exactly, you have to believe that the gap between what we have and what we want is tremendous. But we have been getting all kinds of emails from people. For example, one email we got from somebody tried to argue with us that what we haven't done correctly is we haven't accounted correctly for the balance sheet of the very wealthy. And he said, well, you know, the very wealthy, of course, own a lot, but the government at any point in time could come back and change the rules and re-tax people. And the poor people are actually a liability on their asset sheet. So if you only have to think about it correctly, you would realize that the wealthy actually don't have much money because much of this money is at risk. And what happens if the government will come and take them? So people have an incredible capacity to rationalize whatever worldview they have, and we are getting lots of emails to prove that that point. But still, I think that we need to. I think we're making small dents. You know, we're academics. We're not looking for quick solutions and fast things. We're used to slow process. But I think getting people to pay more attention to it, to consider it, to look at other people in society, to try and see who the poor are and who the wealthy are, and what the real gap is, and really think about what we want, like what society would we really want to live in, I think is quite eye-opening, and I'm hoping that over time we would get people to reconsider their position.
Michael Norton, anything to add?
The last thing I would add is just that we're looking at, so we've been talking about wealth and income, and it is the case that Americans believe that some inequality is okay in these sorts of outcomes. So it's okay for there to be poor people and there to be rich people. In other domains, so we have some new data, for example, on health inequality. So imagine I asked you this question: of the infants that die in the United States this year, what percent of them should be poor and what percent of them should be rich? And it's very, very difficult to say, I believe that more poor children should die than rich people. People will say, I think it's okay that there are poor people and rich people, without making the link that it's the differences in wealth that actually relate to differences in infant mortality. So part of what we're trying to do now is to think about what are metrics where people really, really believe in equality, and then tie those to the overall differences in wealth to try to show people how these differences play out in other domains.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping a look, taking a look on it, look at it later on when you have more to tell us about this. It's very interesting. Thank you so much.
Take care.
We've been talking about wealth distribution in the U.S. and how we actually perceive this disparity. I've been speaking with Dan Ariely and Michael Norton. Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist and professor at Duke University. His latest book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. And Michael Norton is a professor at Harvard Business School. His forthcoming book is Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Emily Rooney is back with me here in Studio 3. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Kelly. You know, we're going to kind of continue with that theme that you were just talking about with Dan Ariely. It's sort of like repayment. How do you pay a debt off to society? Or maybe it's something more simple, like a thank you. But we've got Robin Abrams from the Boston Globe, and we're going to be discussing things like, I owe you. You know, how do I pay you back?
Well, that's a good one, I have to say. A lot of that going on that needs to happen. We need to just know how to say thank you, I think.
All right, Callie, I'm Emily Rooney. Thank you for listening, and we'll be right back.